Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sunday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And believe me, folks, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States, just the United States alone, living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. I know I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I tried to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neurofatigue, anger, or any of the other various symptoms of brain injury. And believe me, there are a lot. Let me tell you just a little snippet about me. For those of you who might be new to my show, I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog, Surviving Traumatic BrainInjury.com. Now, this is the point in the show where I always remember to say, have a pencil and paper nearby, because I will be throwing out some URLs at you that you can look into later after the show, not now. So anyhow, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. It's all one word. It's all lowercase. I shared David's, that's my husband, and my story in 4 episodes on this very show starting in August 2014, the last of which in November 2014 featured a discussion with David himself. So I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years. We're now, I can say, after 17 years, and those numbers keep marching on, and I guess that's a good thing. And I also interviewed him because he's a retired professor of microbiology from Columbia University, and I wanted to get his understanding on the COVID-19 pandemic. And so David was very gracious about coming on and talking about the early stages of the COVID-19, and he still does a lot of the research for it on his own now. He's retired from Columbia now, but he still does a lot of the research, looking through the articles of other scientists and listening to podcasts from other scientists, one in particular who's a professor friend of his from Columbia, and he digests all that stuff and then regurgitates it out so that we as lay people can understand what the scientists are talking. Because I can tell you, after living with a scientist for many, many years, and that's more than those 17 I said, it's a different language. You know, you don't have a clue what they're saying. But he does make it so that we can understand it, and I think that's really very helpful. So you can find any of my archive shows on my blog at, again, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click on the air show menu tab. It's under the category section on the right sidebar. So it's really, really easy. Or you can just type David Figurski, Figurski, in the search box in the right sidebar to learn even more. You can also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was released in November 2018. So you can find Prisoners, as I very fondly call it, as an e-book and as a print book, and most recently as an audiobook, which I was able to read to make that happen. So, and you can find all those in your local book haunts. You can find them in your, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, indie bookstores, Kobo. I could go on and on. You could also find them in your libraries. Now, if your library or your bookstore doesn't have it, ask them to order it. They will. Don't worry. They will. So anyhow, yeah. So if you go to my website now, another URL coming at you, DonnaFigurski.com, you'll find all, not everything, but you'll find a lot of out about me in the book. And the fun part about it is you will find most of the cast of characters that are in the book. You'll see their pictures. They'll be identified. So as you're reading the book, it's more fun to actually have a face that goes with it. So I think that's kind of neat. So I hope that you'll find my show tonight fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m. That's Pacific time, so just do your time conversions there. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on weekends, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, to listen to your favorite shows then, too. And don't forget, every other Sunday, first and third Sunday, you can hear me. And on the second and fourth Sunday, you get to hear my good friend Lisa Dreyer. So, yeah, we've got you covered. All right, so Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 countries. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And I'm going to give you a little introduction to my guest tonight, who I'm really excited to talk to. As we know, brain injury is shattering at any time of life. But it's even more devastating when it happens to a young person. Teenagers should be texting with their friends, frequenting the food courts at the mall, playing soccer, baseball, volleyball, or whatever sport they like. They should be hiking, spending a day at the beach, that's what I would be doing, or hanging out with their special friends. Those are the kinds of things that most teenagers enjoy. But when my guest this evening, Karina Seda, was 15 years old, she had a brain injury which changed the course of her life forever. That brain injury actually started several years earlier, and Karina's going to explain that to us. Karina's positive attitude kept her on a restorative path towards recovery. Of course, we all know that rarely does someone completely recover from a brain injury. That is so true. When the doctors told me that David would recover 95%, I was like, oh no, that's not good enough. Well, I would be happy for 95% now. They were a little off on their prediction. David's not quite 95%. But you know what? I'm still happy for whatever degree we have. But again, it's a rare situation where anyone can recover completely from a brain injury. But there are some. There are some out there. But usually there are many lingering effects, some drastic and very visible effects, and some that are drastic and invisible. I know, that's really weird, but we can talk about that too. No matter what the repercussions of brain injury, brain injury is a life changer. So I'd like to welcome Karina Seda to the show tonight to share her story of how she had a stroke at 15 years old and how she is molding her life in a most positive manner. So Karina Seda, thank you for joining me tonight and welcome to my show.
Hello, hello, Donna. Donna, can
I'm
you
so
hear
happy
me?
To yes, I certainly can.
Okay.
Good,
perfect.
I can. And I'm so glad to have you on because Karina and I had a chance to chat, I think it was last week already. So it was really, really fun to do. So we're just going to continue our chat. And you guys can just be like a fly on the wall and listen in. Don't you ever like to do that when you're at a restaurant and you hear somebody's conversation and you just like stop and listen? That's kind of how I feel with what's happening here when we're talking on the radio, because I'm in my space, Karina's in her space, and you guys are all just listening to us talk. So anyhow, sit back, relax, and listen. So Karina, before we go into the event that caused your brain injury, can you tell us what your life was like before the stroke happened and what kind of a kid you were? What kind of things did you enjoy doing? I just want to know who Karina was even, you know, as a young child.
Sure. Those are great questions. As you were in the introduction, right? First, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here with you all, and thank you for the people who are connecting with us today. Well, my life before my stroke, as you mentioned in the introduction, a teenager, right? And where we find ourselves like starting a new journey, like starting to make decisions, what I want to do, or I want to work on this type of field, I want to, you know, we are preparing and thinking about what we really want to do. So before the stroke, I found myself in the school. I was in at that time in a vocational school, to share with you all. So one of my passions was to work in the medical field as a medical emergency. So I was like a teenager preparing, right, and my future. And to share with you all, I have everything prepared. And since before the stroke, everything, all planned, or everything planned out, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
But a very interesting thing to share with you when you mention that there is no age, right? There is no age nowadays to have a such condition or something that happened in our life, right? Because everything happened with a purpose, to share with you as well. My journey, if we go back a little bit years later, my journey began when I was 12 years old. At that time, the doctors diagnosed with an aneurysm at that age.
Yeah, that's early.
So pretty much my life since that was around, I had to change the way I eat. I have to start changing a few things in my routine as well, like a young child, right? Being the first child in Puerto Rico to find such condition and such treatments, everything start at young age. So, yeah, it was very, you know, very surprising at that time, at that young age. And also, you know, all my life was very dedicated, a very dedicated student, and, you know, keeping my grades and all, thinking about my future. I want to do this, I want to do that. And I wanted to even go to the army, one of my dreams, you know, or of planning my career at young age as well.
Wow. So when this happened, when you had the aneurysm at 12, what did they do? They knew it was there, but you didn't have surgery or have it clipped or taken out in any way, right? You were living with that?
Well, they, it's a interesting thing to share, right? But basically, they discovered, because I was very an active person. I was, as a child, I was in all sport. I was very active at the school as well. I was, you know, playing volleyball, basketball, running, playing with children in my neighborhood. So at one time where we start looking some changes. So everything started that I was getting tired very easily, like very, I was playing with a short time and I was experiencing or getting this strong headache. So I had to, stop here, I don't feel very good. And, you know, I was returning to my home, and my mom started, hey, Karina is not like this. Something is happening here. So at first, they thought it was a migraine, but I keep having these symptoms and sensitivity. When I was out, you know, playing outside, I started getting sensitive with the light, and I was it had a time that I had to go inside a place, you know, to rest a little bit because of that sensitivity I was having as well. Until I was able to have an MRI, an MRI as well, to confirm that condition, because when the results came out from my first test, they didn't believe it. No, this is going to be true, right? So they run another test to make sure that it was an aneurysm. I was lucky that my mom was, you know, very, very active at that. Hey, we need to do something, because when they discovered my aneurysm was about to, so was in moment. So they run very quick to the hospital where the doctor, the neuro doctor was, you know, active at that time. So my mom was my ambulance, running all those streets fast to be able to take action as soon as possible. I was lucky at that time, you know, that first event, that first attempt to have a stroke, right? To have that event. Mm-hmm. So they catch it on time. I was lucky at my 12 years old. They catch it.
Wow.
And the first things they do was to, you know, to keep it in control. And after my 12 years old, every 2 years, I was getting, you know, evaluated. Different, they call different catheterism, embolizations, but basically they open and to evaluate, hey, how is going? It is getting bigger. It is any changes around as well. You know, the test they ruined if I was, all my extremities was working correctly. And pretty much since my 12 years until my 15, where they determined this is going to be your last operation, your last embolization. You know, after this, your aneurysm is under control.
Yeah.
You are able, you know, to have your life, you know, everything normal. Everything was good, you know. I was keeping active. I was still in sports. I was swimming. I was able to participate in some dancing competitions, and I keep my active life. You know, I was participating with my friends and going out. And as you mentioned, as a teenager, we go to the beach. We are testing here. Let's go out. Let's go. Let's plan to go to the movies. And, you know, very, very active social as well.
Wow. So what happened in your 15th year when you had the stroke? How did that happen? Because, I mean, they told you that you're going to be okay, and then all of a sudden you're not now.
Yes. So everything was great after that last embolization, that last event where they clip it, and that's it. They, you know, they fill it out, the aneurysm, with all of the things or the steps they have as a treatment for the aneurysm. Everything went well. The operation, everything, it was a successful one. But when I was in the recovery room, I vomit. And usually when we go to those operations, we are fasting, right? And so, all of a sudden, I vomit. So it causes that the intracranial pressure rose, causing the stroke. So the aneurysm not the one who popped. It was another artery next to the aneurysm. And that
popped. Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's so awful. Here you think you're on the road to recovery. You're going to be fine now. You've already spent 3 years really focused on your, the limitations that it gave you at that point. And you think everything's going to be great. And then it's like you rise to the surface and then you go pushed right back down. And that's just awful. So then what happened, Karina? You had the stroke. That's definitely going to affect you in so many different ways than the aneurysm when it wasn't, when it was just there and you were living with it carefully. So what happened then?
Yes, what happened then? Everything changed. To share with you, everything changed. And if I go a little bit earlier, because my last operation was on May 2014. So during that summer, I was, I have my plans to go to a model school and everything, but everything changed. So my habits changed as well. My routine, my social activities changed. My desire as well, because now I need to look at what I can do, right? It is not just what I want to do, my desire, my goal or my desired career, but now what I can do now on. So basically everything changed. It was a huge, I call it, I know that people are used to call it 180 degree, but I add a little bit because it is a huge 190 degrees, I call it, because it is a big change. It impacts our life physically, mentally, and emotionally, everything. Everything is involved in this new journey.
It truly is. Your whole life gets turned upside down at that point. When I know, were you had to learn to walk again, didn't you? Were you put into that kind of a state?
Yes. So after a stroke, in my case, I lost all movement on the left side of my body. So I had to relearn how to walk, how to talk as well. I remember I was taking help or training to be able to swallow, and all process again, when we are teaching babies how to do things, or it's little by little, everything step by step, walking, talking, move my eyes as well, Donna, because in my case I had my eyes were stuck facing a single direction. So at that time, I have visitors that they had to move around. Karina, are you able to see me here? That way I was able to see them at that time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know that's what happened to David when he had his brain injury too. He was reduced to what we call infantile state. He had to relearn everything as a baby does, and it sounds very much like that's what's going on with you too. He was not able to feed himself. He was not able to dress himself. He wasn't able to walk. He couldn't even talk in the beginning. It was very, very garbled. His speech right now is still it's not like it used to be, but people can understand him now, but it's obviously people know that there's something wrong, that something had happened to his speech. It was just, and the swallow, as you said too, Karina, David has the swallow disorder and still does. So also has to be very, very careful about every bite that goes into his mouth, because it could cause asphyxiation, where you swallow your food. That causes, I think that's what it's, no, I'm not sure. I'm getting my words mixed up there, so forget that. But anyhow, so, you know, so everything is very, you know, very, very different. And here he was 57 when he had his brain injury. So he had a full life of his career that he wanted and desired, as you say, that you had wanted and desired and planned for. He had all of that, which was fortunate. But a lot of people don't get that. And a lot of people get their brain injuries much later. I really wish if he was going to have a brain injury, he would have waited till about 80 or 90 years old. But that, you know, it just doesn't happen that way. And I'm sure that you would have preferred, you know, probably not to have your brain injury as well, because it does. It changes your life. You said 190 degrees. Yeah, it does. It really just turns you right upside down. And so talk about how you started to regain your mobility and your speech and everything. How long did that take, and did you have rehab, and how was your life during that period of time? Because, like, again, we're going back to a teenager who should be at the beach or the mountains or walking, climbing, and or the malls. And how did that affect you?
Yes. So first, I was. We all are different. We all have our unique journey here. But in my case, at first, I was in coma for around 2 weeks. But after that, the first step, they have me intensive therapy, and I was inpatient after those 3 weeks in the prairie, right, recovering or coming back as well. It was around 1 month on inpatient. But after that, I keep going as well. One of the things before inpatient to share with you all, our first goal is to get up, right? Get that first step. So my goal was, you know, to be able to go out at least walking with assistance. So in my case, I was able to go out in around 1 month because I was very motivated from my family members who planned a horse rally, and I love horses. I wanted to be there, and that was my motivation. My yes, I want to be there. I am going to be there at least in a wheelchair, but I am going to be there. And but no, I didn't use the wheelchair either. My first, everything started when I did my first step. I was able to get up, use those first steps. I exit the rehab, the inpatient rehab, walking with an Emmy walker. That was my first, this journey, starting to get independent post-stroke, walking with an Emmy walker. After that, a little by little, with some outpatient therapy as well. And then I moved to start walking with a cane, a 4-point cane. The great thing as well is that at the beginning, you know, we have our diagnosis that, hey, you are not going to walk again. You are not going to school again. Another goal after being on that horse rally was going back to school. I want to go back to school. So I worked very hard during that summer to going back to school. And for the glory of God, I was able to go back to school. And then was when I started working with the cane. But even though I believe I start the my first day walking with the Emmy Walker in the school.
Hmm. You know, when you went back to school, that's got to be a huge challenge. You had great motivation to get back there. But when you left there, you were the old Karina, and you came back as a new Karina with disabilities at this point. How did you deal with that? How did you yourself deal with going into school with the cane? I know this answer, but I want to hear it from you. And then I also want to hear, how did your friends and how your schoolmates and everybody, how did they react to you after you had your brain injury?
It was a chaos for everyone. Things I heard when I was in the hospital, they had to stop some of the tests they were going because my friends also was going through this, because having an event like this, Donna, it affects our family, our friend. It is not just, it is like all our cycle, right? The people that are next to us, or that share things with us, are also going through this with us. They are the one who are seeing us. And back then, I remember they telling me, hey, Karina, we didn't have to take this test because we were unable to do it. But I remember I have some visits in my hospital, visit during the summer, a lot of support for my friends at that time. One of them was like my mom's support as well, where he was the one, his name is, and he was the one who was there and saw me, when we are in the hospital, we go through these old things, when we are in coma, we start like a little bit disoriented, going back a little bit. So he was helping my mom as well, at that part, caregiver support as well, because she needs to work at that time as well. So he was the one, I remember my mom picking up him to be able to stay with me while we were waiting on the classes to start in Puerto Rico. I remember we start around 8 a.m. and it's at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. There are people already in the school and waiting, the breakfast or something like that. So we get up very early to be able to have him and help me, because I know I share about the Emmy Walker, but before the equipment were provided, I remember that my mom was my cane and my friends were the one who carried me until the equipment were provided.
Wow. Yes. Two things that you were just talking about there that I want to touch on is one of them, well, actually three maybe. One of them was, you are so right when you say that the victim, the survivor, is not the only one affected by a brain injury. The family is. The family is very definitely affected. The mom, the dad, the wife, the husband, whatever, the children are very much affected by what's happening to someone in their home that they love a lot. So that it's not, people think, that David had a brain injury, and they ask about David all the time, and still do, even after 17 years, like, how's David doing? How's David doing? And very rarely do they think to ask about, well, how are you doing? Even though, I came in, I was there all the time, but I was there for him all the time and still am there for him all the time. And I am a part of this journey that we're going on as a caregiver, as his wife. And people don't really get that. So it was interesting to hear you say that, people that other, the people that are involved in and around you in your little orbit of your world that are important to you and you are important to them are also very much affected by the brain injury. And so, yeah, I think people need to think about that too, that it's other folks are being really impacted by the things that happen to somebody else in their life. And, you know, so sometimes I'm just saying to the folks out there, if you know somebody that has a caregiver, you might want to give them a little pat on the back too sometimes, or just a concern. How are you? You know, I know you're doing a lot. How are you doing? How are you taking everything? You know, can I do anything for you? I think those kinds of things are very helpful to the extraneous people that are involved in the brain injury. So just a good thought there. I'm glad you brought that up, Karina. Another thing I wanted to say, oh, I guess it was just two, talking about your friend David, who went out of his way to make sure you were okay when your mom was not able to be there for you and he stepped up. That's really the definition of friendship and caring. So that you were very lucky that happened. I'm sure it happened because of who you are, but still, a lot of people turn away, and you know they're there for the initial event. When the event happens and they found out you had a stroke and you were in the hospital, I'm sure a lot of friends came to visit, maybe daily or once a week or whatever. But they were there, concerned, and then eventually, what happens? And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it's a normal thing. It's life. They kind of drift away. They get back into their own lives. The emergency of the situation is over, and people drift back into their own lives. And what you thought might have been a really good friend turns out not to be such that great friend that you thought, because you are no longer able to satisfy their needs as a friend. For example, and I'm going to go to teenagers at this point. So you no longer can go to the beach with your friends. You no longer can, you know, get on the phone. You know, someone calls you and says, hey, let's go to a movie. And you can't do it anymore. So that makes a divide, starts a divide between people. And the drift happens. Just people, you know, start drifting away. And did you find that was happening to you at all?
Well, on my story was, I believe that I agree with that. You know, it was at one time. Everything was at the beginning. It was when I really need about them the most, they were there. At the beginning, uh-huh. You know, when adjusting that new year, 11th grade for myself, when we start that new year, they all were over there. So on my side was a little bit contrary, because they were there. And I remember when we were changing of different classes, they carry me between classes. Some of my friends, you know, the peers were there as well. Until I reached a point where I found myself, I can do this. I am able to do it. And I remember that I forgot my cane. And one day, and I was alone pretty much that day, and I was holding the walls while I was changing classes, but they were there, you know, watching by myself as well. At one point, I had to tell them, I can do it. I got this, because they were there all of the time. And sometimes we want our time as well, right? We want our space. So they, on my side, was a little bit contrary. They were all there all of the time until I found myself, I can do this. And I have to do it, because if I don't do the work, I don't, you know, I need to put my hand working. I need to move my leg as well. I need to carry my things to have that balance. I need to, you know, until they start, okay, Karina needs to do the things as well. So when that happened, a little bit by a little, that was the right time, because as you mentioned, we are all like with I know we all have our life. At that time, they are also looking where, what I am going to do next, what university I am going to join, and all those things as we all start going, right, where we start our own journey, our professional journeys as well. So everything happens like at the right time.
That's good. That sounds like you had a really good situation there. And I was laughing because when you said, I can do it, you know, they have to stop helping me. I get that because as my husband David's caregiver, I'm always looking out to see what I can do to make his life easier. Because for David, he has his balance challenged. So it's very difficult for him to walk unassisted. He can a little bit now, but it's a little precarious. So, but you know, it, and things like he's got ataxia in his right arm, so he can't use that right hand for things. So he does everything left-handed and kind of uses that right hand as an assist if he can, but it's shaking so much. So when I see him trying to open a bottle or a can, I like, want me to do it for you? I'll do it. You know, this kind of thing. And finally, one day, well, a couple times he had said to me, I can do it. You know, I can do it. And I took a front to that. I was like, well, geez, that's not very nice. I'm offering to help you. And he's, well, you know, saying, no, I don't need your help. And I like, okay, well, I felt bad. I felt like he was kind of pushing me aside on that. And then happened again another time. He noticed my feeling because I usually didn't let him see it. But this time he happened to see it, which started a conversation, which I wish had happened much earlier. And we talked about just that, my helping him too much. Now, it wasn't really too much, but there was sometimes that he just could do it himself, and he needed to do it himself, just like you did, so that he could get stronger. He also needed to do it himself for his own self-esteem. And I'm guessing that's probably a lot of what, you know, happened with you too. We all want to be independent. I mean, everybody usually does. Most people don't want to be able to have to rely on somebody else. And when that happens in this kind of a situation where David does have to rely on me for a lot of things, but apparently there are a lot of things he doesn't have to rely on me for, and he wants to have the option of being able to do them on his own. I mean, even... what was it? Yesterday, he was doing the laundry. He does the laundry in our house. And so he was doing the laundry, and he was having a hard time opening the laundry bottle or whatever he was opening there. And I said, do you want me to do it? And he goes, no, I can do it. But I saw him struggling. So my first inclination is, I'll help you. I'll do it for you. And he said, but now I know. So when he said, no, I can do it, I said, okay. I'm off to whatever else I was ready to do, you know. But we've come to terms with that because of our conversation. So when things like this happen, you have to let people know. You have to talk. I think that's the best thing in between a caregiver and a survivor. You have to talk about the situation and let your other person know what you need or what you want or how things are affecting you. Because the last thing in the world I wanted to do is to impinge on David's self-esteem. I mean, that's the last thing I would have wanted to do. I am his biggest cheerleader. I'm trying to make sure that he is feeling good about himself, about, you know, as he's going through this journey of brain injury. So I'm glad to hear, Karina, that you were able to let your friends know that, yeah, thank you for helping me. I appreciate your helping me, but I need to do it myself because nobody's going to help me my rest of my life. And you don't want that anyhow.
Exactly. Yes, I agree. And it's like I share with other people as well. Communication is the key in so many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that is another huge, huge, huge topic to talk about. We can spend hours as well. But communications between caregivers and survivors is very, very essential, very important. And also depending on the phase, right, that where we are at the beginning, I remember... And here I share this and with everyone before the stroke. That before the stroke happened, my mom and I had this technique or this preparation or things that we sometimes talk about, because we had always, and my mom and I have a great communication as well, but is that if something happened as an emergency, as something, right, like these events that are unexpected, we don't have a date, hey, at this time you are going to have this happen to you. So we were prepared that if something happened, the last thing we as humans lost is the hearing, the being able to listen. So my mom and I had this planning that if something happened where I am unable to speak, but we are able to move one part of our body or our hands, squish the hand if she is asking a question. A yes mean one squish, like holding that her hand, meaning, Karina, this is yes, okay. Are you listen to me? Yes, no. Squish that first time if it is a yes, or two times if it is a no. It is a great way to communicate. That was the thing we used when I was in coma, because we are, you know, in that we are like out, right? We are in coma, but we are still listen. We hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a way of communication to have, and it's helpful for everyone, you know, to have that with their children's family members. Oh, something happened. Mm-hmm. Hey, if this happened, we have this, we know this thing between us, and other things as well, right? Between families can have things like that, just in case in any emergency. That is a way to communicate as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm tickled that you said that, because that's exactly what we do. And when my daughter was very, very young, when she was a baby, we did three squeezes to say I love you. So you could be walking, or when she was a toddler, we're walking across the parking lot to go meet her father's bus, and I would just squeeze her hand three times, and she would just squeeze my hand three times. We never said a word that we loved each other, but it was there. And so, yeah, we started that three squeezes way, way, way back when she was a toddler. And then when David was in the hospital, I did the same thing to David, because this was a family thing. And I would squeeze three times, and he would squeeze back three times while he was in coma. That's why I knew that he was still there. Because that happened. Then when he was in the recovery room and my children were able to get to the hospital from California and New Mexico, and I was right outside of New York and New Jersey, so they did this thing. We called it the squeeze game. In fact, it's in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. I talk about this very thing. I'm just looking to see what chapter it is. Yeah, the squeeze game, chapter 7, page 37. And what the kids would do is one got on one side of the bed, the other on the other side. And again, David's in a coma. And like you say, people don't think that people in a coma can hear, but I think they can. I've seen it several times with different people where they are aware. So doctors should not be saying things, or people should not be saying things like, what funeral home do you want him to be, you know? Because you can hear that. So anyway, one of my kids was on one side, the other was on the other, and they would ask questions. And they explained to David, if the answer is yes, squeeze your right hand. The answer is no, squeeze your left hand. So they would go through, and my daughter would say, Dad, do I have two boys? And he would squeeze the no hand. And then he would say, do I have two girls? And he would squeeze the yes hand. So we were asking questions that we knew the answers to that would verify that he was understanding. And we did this game the very first night in recovery. You know, and so I do believe in that too. And it's a great thing. It's a good tip on for other people to know that if you have this, we didn't set it up, Karina, as you and your mom did, as if anything happens. We just did it as a part of our life, and then it came in handy. So, but what people are hearing, what we're talking about right now on this show, it's not a hard thing to set into place. And then if something does happen to somebody and they are in a coma, you do have that way of communicating. You do have a way of connecting to find out if they're really able to be conscious enough to understand what's going on or what's happening. You know, so yeah, it's a really good point. I'm so glad you brought that up. But that's really cool.
Yes, it's very important as well, because it's a way to, at that point they are thinking, hey, it's time to disconnect it, you know, and it is a huge thing to have as well, right, to save life, because if we are still here, we have a purpose, if we have something to accomplish, and we, you know, there is a reason why we come here and we stay here as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, so when you said that, if they wanted to disconnect, and this conversation, oftentimes I know this happens, that where people are in a room with somebody who's unconscious, and maybe they've had a terrible accident, and they think the doctor has said they're not going to survive. And so the people are all around the bedside, and they're talking about, you know, should we turn and pull the plug, or as they say. Turn off life support, you know. And the other person who can't communicate, who's lying there saying, wait a minute, don't do that, you know, but has no way to let anyone know that they are conscious and that they are viable still in their life. So, I think it's a really good thing to set into place for other folks so that, you know, you do have that way to make your connection and if it happens to be you, at least you have the connection. You can make that connection. I suppose, yeah, somebody has to touch your hand in order for you to do it, because you're not going to be able to reach out if you're in coma. So, yeah. So think about that, folks. That's a good piece to walk away. If it's anything from the show, that's one interesting thing. Among many, I should say. But, Karina, I always like to ask my guests, how they feel about their lives after their brain injury. I would expect that most would scoff at that question and wonder why I ask such nonsense. But I have learned that many, many survivors that I interview surprise me with their answer. I always think that folks are going to say, well, my life is much better. I want my life back, blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. And I was shocked when someone first told me, I'm really happy with my life afterwards. And I was like, then I was starting to hear that more and more. So I'm just wondering, how do you feel, Karina? Do you feel your life is better or worse? And can you explain why?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned right before, everything changed. Everything, my career, my habits, my social activities, my desires. However, everything changed, and I believe, right from my heart, everything changed for the better. Nowadays, Donna, I am living with a purpose. I am married with my soulmate. After my stroke, I found my soulmate, and I married him. Mm-hmm. And also, I am helping others to live and be the best version of themselves. So in my case, I believe, you know, it is a beauty how things happen, learn new things, look things with another point of view. And so it is for the better. It is for the better in my case as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I knew you were going to say that, because I just know how you are right now. I mean, I've only met you for, you know, a little bit. I've only known you for a little bit and been able to talk to you for a little bit. But the point is that I felt that that was the kind of an answer that you were going to give based on just the stuff that I've learned about you. But it's kind of shocking to me when I hear this. And it's not unusual to hear it. And that's what I think is so amazing, that it's, you know, I still hear the people who said, I can't wait. I wish I could get my life back better, you know, put my life before better back. And I was much happier then, and I really would like that and not what I have now. But then there are the counterpart of that. There are so many people that say, no, I'm a better person now. And it's like, wow, I have, well, the friend I was talking about in the beginning, the very first person we ever asked this question of, you know, had what did she have? Oh, she has MS, and she is wheelchair bound. And she had it when she was a little bit older, so she was probably about in her 50s around then when that happened. And David had already had his brain injury, and he also knows Harriet, who was a part of my writing group. And so we just asked her, what do you feel like? What is your life like? Do you feel, are you bitter about it? Are you upset that your life has been torn away from you like that? And her answer shocked us. She said, no. She said, I'm a much better person now. And I thought, like, holy moly, she is. She's a very sweet person. I didn't know her beforehand. But she's a very sweet person, but I can't imagine her any other way. But her comment was, I'm a much better person now. And yet she's so limited in the fact that she can't get out of that wheelchair without help. And that's not changing. Now, I went through that stage with David when he was not able to get out of the wheelchair with no help. He just could not do it. There was no way. And it was pretty bad, you know. It wasn't very nice. I don't know how that would have been if he had to live his whole life that way. Because David also has a very positive attitude. I'm sure he would have been, you know, he would have made the best of it. But I was shocked. I was really shocked. And then when I started doing the interviews on survivors speak out and caregivers speak out, but mostly the survivors part, those interviews, which folks out there, you can read more about Karina on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com under Survivors Speak Out. Her interview was published today. So, but when I started to do those, and out of that questionnaire, one of my questions was, how do you feel about your life now? Is it better or worse? And it's amazing how many people have said it's better. I just, like, I'm totally shocked. But I'm also very, very glad. I'm very glad that people can realize that no matter what life you have, no matter what path you're going down, if you make the best of it, you can make it a good life. And I think that's the purpose of what you do, because none of us is ever given a, you know, carte blanche on a perfect life. You know, in everybody's life, they say, some rain must fall. Sometimes it's just a drizzle. Sometimes it's a thunderstorm. And I think when somebody has a brain injury, it's kind of like a thunderstorm. But if you can get through it and make the best of it, I think you're doing really, really well. And, you know, again, the choices. Karina, you had choices before. You said, you mentioned something about you wanted to go to modeling school. You wanted to go to the Army. You had other different things. You're going to college and things like that for various plans that you had as a young teenager. Very, very solid, good plans in your mind. And then they were all taken away. Yet you didn't become bitter over it. You worked harder. You worked harder to make your life a valuable commodity again. You made it a very, you wanted to help others, I can tell with that. And that's what it's all about, figuring out alternative pathways. Because everybody's life changes, whether you have a brain injury or not. You could be working at a job and then get fired or have to quit or have family circumstances. Things change, and we have to be kind of pliable with those changes. Otherwise, you get stuck, you know, and you can get bitter. So you have to, you know, kind of flow, go with the flow. And so I see, Karina, that you are now a life stroke coach, and it sounds to me like that's your new path. So can you talk about how you decided upon this as a career?
Sure, that is a great as everything, right, it comes along, and once you align with your purpose, things are very different. A few things here. First, we all have in different phases, right? When we all, when you were mentioning about a different, you know, hey, I am here, and we are all different. Some of them are good, or they are better, right? Their life are better after a stroke, and for other, no. And I believe that we all have phases post-stroke. At the beginning, we are going through that acceptance, right? Why this happened, or mm-hmm. for what this happened.
Yeah.
So few things here involve as well. And get, right? Involve the support we are receiving as well, the environment we are in as well, right? All of the things that get in consideration towards the decisions we are making, the choices as well we make, right? We choose, and those decision makers, a lot of things going on around and that phase. And so all of this goes along with myself, like having this new career. Everything start with on 2019, where I was working. I was, after my stroke, I was able to finish my BA and everything. So I was working for corporate, different corporations as well. But I found myself, something inside of me telling me, I can do more. So, and there was a time in my journey, right, in my life, where I let that, like, open, and I follow that intuition as well, where I can do more. So in 2019, I switched my career. I did another 180-degree change in my life, right, about career change. And during that change, I have people telling me, Karina, you have this. You are like this career is for you. And that was to become a health and life coach. So I tried, right? I went over that certification. I became a certified health and life coach. Another journey to start as well. At the beginning, I start helping people lose weight, like more declining on my health certification. But still, mm-hmm. I found myself, I can do more. Like, this is not. Until I share my story with one of my mentors, or, you know, the coaches I was learning mm-hmm. from those people who I was learning. I share my story, and they told me, Karina, you have something here. You need to share that. Like, more, like, going to that purpose until that mm-hmm. happens, and I start aligning myself with my purpose. After that, I start switching my practice, my coaching practice, to help survivors, helping prevent or become independent from the stroke, you know, so they can live and thrive without limits. And if mm-hmm. I can do it, I believe others can too. And the beauty of everything is that we all have a unique journey after this event.
Yeah, that's true. I'm so glad that you found, with the help of your friends, basically, your mentors, found exactly what you need to do, because I think it is exactly what you need to do. You know so much about this. And I know that your motto on your website is live, survive, and thrive without limits. So how do folks thrive without limits? And how do you thrive without limits? So maybe by just telling me how you do, then we'll know how other folks can.
Great question. And the point here is having that support and accountability. And it's a huge, experiencing, having a being able to see by it is It is a huge different approach when we work with a coach, Donna. It is mm-hmm. having someone holding you, like being with you and being able to explore with you what you are capable of as well. Having someone mm-hmm. next to you, walking with you is a huge difference because, as you mentioned, throughout our journey, we get stuck. And that is the most frustrating part, like suffering by us alone, because I know we get this. We believe it, and I believe in you all who are listening with are connecting with us today. We can do it, right? We can do. We are strong. We are warriors, and there is a purpose because you all are still in this world. You all have a mission to accomplish, but it is a transformation. When we work with a coach, we are working toward recovery in a transformational way. So how I do it is also I have my own coach as well, you know, helping me through this, and they are there with me, you know, when I have my doubts, my, you know, those moments as well, having someone, mm-hmm. You know, I know that some of us, yes, like encouraging, that motivation is not everything. We do more. It is a transformational work we are having when we work with a coach.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's really cool. So how do people find you if they want to check out your services?
Sure. I have my...
No, go ahead. It was just a lag there.
Yes. Okay. So I have my page. My first, or like the first go to, right, is it is lwlwks.org. Where they are able to see my page, see more, it'll be more. I have something free for you all over there if you register as well. It is very self-explanatory, but that is my main page. And again, it's lwlwks.org.
Okay, and I'm just going right to that site right now. I've been to it. And, you know, it's funny because I wrote on my notes .com, you know, because I didn't look at it by address carefully enough. Yeah, okay, five. Oh, okay. No, I didn't go to this one. But there you are.
I have
that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've gone to a different one too. But it's, I don't know what it was now, but it looks different. But anyhow. Yeah, so that Karina's website, Karina Seda, S-E-D-A, her website is lwlwks.org. And, yeah, so you should take some time after the show to take a peek into what Karina does offer, because she really is very positive in wanting to not only help herself in her recovery, but also offering to help other folks too. So you can find out more about Karina there. Karina, do you have any final words of advice before we have to sign off? These minutes went by so, so fast.
Yes, they went very fast. I was looking at time here. But one of the things I would say, never give up, and never is too late to integrate into life in a healthy and work toward recovery. So I know that some of us are, and I got my career already. I have everything. I live my life already. And there are still things. There is a mission and to work on, you know, post a stroke, post your event. There is still a mission to find out a purpose in your life to accomplish as well. So never give up, and never is too late to start working or continue working toward recovery.
Actually, that is so true. And I just have to tell you a quick story about a friend of mine who, I don't know how many books she's written. I don't even want to guess, but she's written tons and tons of books. She just is getting ready to publish her next one. She is 88 years old, or she's going to be 88. And I'm not going to say her name now because I told the age, but because she told me that. But, yeah, it's never too late to, follow your dreams. And your dreams can change. You know, the thing is, that's what happens after an event like Karina had, like David had. David is a scientist and probably would have continued in his laboratory and graduating PhD students for years and years and years to come until maybe he was 88 years old, because scientists don't quit. But our paths changed. He did go back to work for 7 years after his brain injury, which was pretty phenomenal. Columbia never expected him to return. They didn't even know how to handle it at first, but they came through and figured it out. He kept his laboratory and kept his students too, which was really cool. So and then he made the change. He decided in 2013 to retire, which is not something David would have done. But interestingly enough, there is life beyond science and beyond the laboratory and beyond Columbia. And I think he's found it. And so that's really, really cool. So the point of that story is that, you know, your life is an open, a blank canvas, and you can paint your way all the way through it in whatever direction or manner you want to. So if you're not happy in what you're doing now, change it. Do something else. Even if it's a slow change, but try it. So on that note, I'm going to have to do my closing housekeeping duties here. So I want to thank Karina Seda so much today for sharing your life and offering hope to other survivors. I hope many, many people have listened to this show, and many, many more will listen to it, because it will be archived on my blog, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com, and just go to that on the air show menu, and there you will find, I think I said I had 160 shows last week. David corrected me and said, Donna, you've got more like 120 shows. So, and that might even be wrong. I might be wrong again, because I get it wrong every time. I just do the shows and don't think about it. He keeps track. But anyway, there are a lot of shows there. There are a lot of shows to choose from, a lot of different guests, a lot of different topics for panels. So go take a peek at it. And you can always learn more about Karina at her website. And I'm going to see if I can remember it. LWLWKS.org. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right. And so on my blog also is a category for brain injury resources, and also the COVID resource that I told you about. There's one about itty-bitty giant steps. There's one about for guest bloggers. So if you want to write something, or let me know, and I will see what we can do. Let's see. I would love if you would read my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. And as I always tell everybody, a review is a book's best friend. I have 98 reviews on Amazon right now. That's low, I know, but I'm striving for the 100. So, folks, write a review and be that 100th person. I'd love for that to happen. Or the 200th or the 500th. That would be even better. So, so check out my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You can find out a whole lot more about it on DonnaFigurski.com. And, again, it's in all of your local book haunts. So check it out, or your library, and if it's not there, ask for it. Because basically you'll learn more about David's and my journey through our brain injury maze. So as I always like to say, if you liked my show tonight, tell 10 of your friends. And if you didn't really like it that much, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So as the clock is ticking up to 6:50, I have to say goodbye, because our new hosts are going to be coming on at 7:45, for a 7 o'clock show, or an 8 o'clock show. No, 7 o'clock Pacific time show. I have to do the time conversions in my head too. So I will see you on the next show, which will be March 6th, and it will be a panel. And I'll tell you what the title is if I have written it down there yet. I know what it is, but I don't know what it is here. It'll be a surprise, but it'll be a good show. So I want to say thank you very much again to Karina Theta for joining us tonight. Karina, I wish you the very, very best and have a great evening. Thank you so
much. Thank
you. All right. See you all in 2 weeks, everybody. And, yes, have a good one. Bye-bye.